That's Debatable is sponsored by MB&G. MB&G are specialists in the esoteric world of vehicle and furniture warranty insurance, delivering quite marvellous customer service, prompt claims payment, and a highly developed understanding of how to deliver these products in a way that is both compliant with the regulations and attractive to customers. Hello and welcome to That's Debatable, the weekly news podcast of the Free Speech Union. Ben, great to see you again. Welcome back to all of our listeners. How's your week been, Ben?
Yeah, very good. Very good. Busy as always. Hello, Tom. And hello. I think probably particularly to new listeners, because we have had this, as we spoke last week, we've had this big surge of members, mostly from Scotland, but not entirely, which has been interesting. So I think there is a sense of, you know, there might be stuff coming down the barrel, like the Scottish Hate Crime Act for the rest of the country in future. Perhaps that's what people are thinking.
It's all been good trends. We've had new sign-ups. We've had a very significant proportion of those from north of the border. We've also seen the number of listeners go up, which is great. Again, another reason to welcome listeners. We've seen that grow relentlessly, and we've been thinking that's fantastic. So obviously, people are subscribing, I hope, and enjoying the podcast. And on that, I would say we're always open for feedback. So do drop a note to one of our email addresses, either help at freespeech or info at freespeechunion.org, and tell us about the podcast. Tell us what you might want us to look into and talk about. I mean, Ben, on that, I sent you a little text a little earlier, or a WhatsApp earlier, about something that struck me over the weekend. I think it is free speech related, and perhaps I am just a little bit overly sensitive to this, but I hate being re-educated. And I've mentioned this a few times, whether it's in a railway station or an airport, I've talked about that. I was watching TV last night. In fact, I was watching the great Stephen O'Grady, one of our colleagues, talking on Free Speech Nation about the Hate Crime Act. And he was fantastic on Free Speech Nation. Yes, I was watching it, you know, eyes glued, and would recommend people to go and listen to that segment. He was very, very good. But in the advert break, I there was this advert that came on about ageism, which was essentially, you know, I don't want us to be ageist as a society. I'm all for everyone of every age having the opportunity to be fully involved in society. But the way this advert was put together, it was saying we all need to change the way we think so that we could all have the chance to age with confidence. So, are you ageist? This sort of, again, Ben, this sort of assumption that there's something we need to be re-educated about, we need to change our thinking, we need to change our speech. And I just find it's so in every corner now. You cannot escape it being preached at by the re-educators.
Well, I'm just looking forward to the next FSU staff trip to Scotland. And if there are any comments about my rapidly receding hairline north of the border, I will be pressing charges against you, Tom, and against other friends and colleagues, I dare say. It's kind of bizarre, isn't it? I mean, the problem, the main problem, it seems to me, with aging is not ageism. It's the fact that things do just get a bit harder and wear and tear and so on. It's a strange way to frame it, I think.
Well, I mean, I shall carry on saying you can't teach an old dog new tricks. I'm not going to stop saying that. And I actually think we should bring back your elders and your betters. I noticed that's a phrase we've retired in the last 30 years. But your elders and your betters used to be, that's what I grew up with, Ben. Not wanting to sound too old-fashioned and be very ageist.
Actually, that's a phrase that certainly I remember hearing as a child, even as a teenager, and also people saying to me, that's not the Christian thing to do. And that is a phrase I do not think I've heard uttered in 15 or 20 years. And
yet you said, when you nicked my lunch last week.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
Christian thing.
But other than that, that's interesting, isn't it? That's a little, there's some sociology of religion going on there. Anyway, Tom, we need to move on, don't we? We've got our
first. We do. Sorry, I'm wittering on.
That's right. Occupational hazard at the Free Speech Union. You should see our meetings. But we do have some good news to celebrate, don't we? Which is PSPOs, which, Tom, you're going to explain what that acronym stands for.
I will do. Yeah. So PSPO stands for Public Spaces Protection Orders. And they were originally set up under the Antisocial Behaviour, Crime and Policing Act of 2014. So they're quite a long-standing concept. And they were aimed at helping local councils crack down on very specific issues such as prostitution in town squares and parks and things like that, or drinking alcohol in specific areas. So, you know, like all these things, they start off sounding pretty reasonable, pretty defensible. But what's happened in, and I'm not sure exactly when this happened, but local authorities across the country started to use these new powers, PSPOs, to impose an ever-increasing number of fines. And some of those fines go up to £1,000. It's not an insignificant amount of money, but for a range of activities that are quite a long way from those original intentions. They're loitering, swearing, even, Ben, walking a dog in the wrong place. And I'm not saying we don't want to see angry dogs in playgrounds and such like, but you know, these powers, these creeping authoritarian powers, have started to sort of get further and further into the local public square.
Yes,
and you know, one councillor is even proposing to bring in a new PSPO linked code, which could see discourteous street performers banned from the borough. Now, that's the whole borough. And the regions that are involved here can be quite small. They can be just the town centre, or they can be an urban area, or even a suburban area, or even a whole borough. And a couple of these are a whole borough. But the point is, before I hand over the baton to you, Ben, the point is that it's us at the Free Speech Union. We, and particularly our legislative affairs officer, Sam Armstrong, and our chief legal counsel, Bryn Harris, have done a bit of a review of these. In fact, quite a long review of these. And in fact, Stephen O'Grady has been involved as well. He's been helping do the research and looked into 15 of these and the variants that there are across the country of this creeping authoritarian PSPO version or incarnation of this idea. And we've had success because we've challenged two councils with judicial review on how they're using the PSPOs, and they've backed down. Redbridge and Cumberland are their two councils that have started to shelve the measures in response just to the legal challenge from a letter to say, you know what, we don't think you're using these lawfully, and we'll put them up for judicial review. So this is a long-standing battle, Ben. I think this is going to be a marathon, not a sprint, because it's very decentralized across the country.
Yes, it's going to be one of these whack-a-mole things, isn't it, where different councils, as we've seen from the examples you've just given, geographically disparate, are popping up with these sorts of policies. And it's worth stressing to listeners that the Free Speech Union is not campaigning to unleash bully XLs in children's playgrounds or prostitution outside school gates. But there is, I mean, nobody will be shocked to hear that there has been mission creep as a result of this act coming into effect and the way in which councils are using it. And one particular example that our colleague, our chief legal counsel, Dr. Bryn Harris, was talking about was this prohibition on causing distress. And he gave the example of walking down the street and talking to a friend or a family member about somebody dying or some other sad news that you've had. Now, if that happened to cause a passerby a feeling of distress, that would make you liable, he has pointed out, even if you didn't intend to cause distress to anybody who was passing by. So as with the Scottish Hate Crime Act, it's a very, very similar phenomenon where there is this vague drafting, there is this misuse of power. And I have to say, the idea of every council in the country being allowed to set up its own free speech rules via these public space protection orders, disaster, yeah. Clearly, utter disaster, as we've seen. But we are winning. We are whacking these particular moles.
And it is great news that we've managed to get a couple of the councils to back down. But you know what these councils are doing, which is so chilling. They're essentially setting their own criminal laws. And Ben, do you remember during COVID? I think it was there was that parish council. Was it Handforth Parish Council?
Yes.
The Jackie Weaver clip.
Yes.
You know, Jackie Weaver, you have no authority here. And it went viral because it was a bit crazy. You know, the characters on the screen, and some couldn't use their screen and they didn't go on mute, and others should have been on mute and did. And, you know, that was a parish council. Okay, so that's quite a small area, probably the sort of the most minor form of local government that there is. But, you know, what I take away from this PSPO use, plus what I take from something like the Handforth, you know, they're not always the brightest and best, are they, our local politicians? Not always. Now, I know we have a lot of very good local councillors, and I know a lot of prime ministers start off as local councillors, so I'm going to couch this in careful terms. But they're not always our brightest and best. Or is that unfair, Ben?
Well, if I measured this solely by how often and how effectively my bin was collected, I would suggest, in fact, that I would not personally trust local government with much power. Let's put it that way. Mm. If that's the measure, So I mean, I think the example, the parallel, I think, between the Hate Crime Act in Scotland, I think is quite striking. Actually, it's just this sort of well-meaning assumption that everyone who's decent must think like we do. There's no conception that people might disagree. There's no thought about what the secondary consequences are going to be, what the inadvertent consequences are going to be. There's no thought about how this might be used maliciously. It's entirely, oh, someone said something horrible, or they're doing something horrible in the town square. Let's pass this and sort it out and not worry about the consequences or think it through. And fortunately, the Free Speech Union and our legal team is there to stop these things in their tracks.
You wanted to move on. You want to move on to the next item, didn't you, Ben?
Well, I did. But before we do, I just wanted to name check our Legislative Affairs Director, Sam Armstrong, who appeared in Byline Times, who published a hit piece on the Free Speech Union on the 11th of April, 2024. And I'm very happy to refer all listeners to Byline Times to click on this article now. And it has a series of shocking revelations in it about our work and our legislative work particularly. And it says that Toby Young, quote, now leads an organization which is involved in developing government legislation such as the Higher Education Freedom of Speech Act and has begun working with councils to enshrine free speech in its policies. These are shocking revelations about an organization founded to protect free speech. We were obviously horrified to see this exposure of how effective our legislative work is and how much reach and success we have. So if you would like, perhaps if you're thinking about signing up as a member and you have not yet, read this hit piece, and I think that will push you over the edge and you'll be subscribing very shortly after reading it.
Mea maxima culpa. We've now got a day trip, yes, haven't we, in hair shirt and ashes down to Canterbury. On broken glass, because what are we thinking, Ben? Doing our job too well?
Shocking stuff.
Shocking stuff. My
Sam
goodness,
Sam particularly should be ashamed of himself.
Shamed.
Right. Anyway, I just wanted to cram that in because I couldn't miss up the opportunity to refer listeners to that. And now we're on to the CAS review, aren't we, Tom?
We are.
Which has been the big news.
It's been big news, and everyone at the Free Speech Union, maybe not some of the more recent joiners of the Free Speech Union, will know how this gender ideology, this transgender ideology, is now approaching, well, it's beyond 40% of our cases. So, you know, when it comes to free speech in this country, what the CAS review was looking into, which was gender identity services for children and young people specifically, is very relevant to everyone who comes to us at the Free Speech Union looking for help, the whole underlying ideology and the issues behind it. It's been all over the news, which I have to say, Ben, is a positive, because we did have the WPATH files, which are a similar kind of revelation that came out a couple of months ago, or a few weeks ago, which did not get any coverage in much of the mainstream media. This, on the other hand, really has got some traction with the mainstream media, which is absolutely key.
There's no way to ignore it, is there? It's huge. There's no way it can be ignored. It's completely transformed the climate in this debate.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I was going through it. I think it has transformed it. I was listening And I spoke to you, I said to you just now, actually, but I was listening to Andrew Doyle talking about it, you know, all the great voices. The LGB Alliance have come out with a statement on this. You know, this is a very good piece of research. It's an amazing piece of research. The two things that jump out from free speech perspective, first of all, the toxicity of the debate. Dr. Cass addresses that directly in her foreword. And to quote one of the more damning things that she says there are a few other areas of healthcare where professionals are so afraid to openly discuss their views, where people are vilified on social media, and where name calling echoes the worst bullying behavior. This must stop. And you know, Dr. Cass is absolutely right. This is why gender critical feminists have had such an awful time. There have been many Cassandras standing up and saying, help, you know, or children need our protection. They are not getting good medical treatment. They're not getting good healthcare treatment if they're suffering from gender dysphoria. And they've been shouted down by the ideologues. They've been told to shut up. And a lot of them have lost their jobs. And a lot of them have lost their voices. And a lot of them are kicked off social media. You know, remember on Twitter, gender critical feminists were being kicked off social media. Well, this is a huge, great moment where Dr. Cass is saying, well, actually, you were right. And by the way, this debate was absolutely toxic, and the speaking that needed to happen was not happening. So that was the first thing. And the second thing that really jumped out at me, obviously, as a data person, is that a lot of these ideas about all these studies about how puberty blockers and such like are reversible, and you can start them at an early age, and it doesn't really matter, and it just gives people time to think. Time to pause. Well, all of those studies are based on very flaky methodologies and very flaky, very difficult to replicate, and didn't have controls and that sort of thing. So all of the rhetoric that has said the debate is over, so the debate has been toxic, and then also it's been the debate is over because the studies say, oh, this is fine. Children can be medicalized and that's okay. You know, so the debate is over. Well, no, it's not. And again, Dr. Cass has made that crystal, crystal clear. She's been criticized for being a bit sort of both sides of the argument. But she has to be, I think, Ben. I don't know what you feel about this and sort of the balance that she's had to take in navigating this polarized debate.
Well, I mean, freedom of speech is nice to have in its own right. Okay, so that's one of the points of it. But also, it is there as a safeguard to stop societies, democratic societies at least, from walking into disasters, because you always have people, or you're supposed to always have people, who are able to say, hang on, I'm not sure about this. Have we thought about X, Y, Z? Mm. And what's happened in the NHS, healthcare sector, universities, and filtering down from universities to every area of society since about 2014, has been that the debate, as you've said, has been completely silenced. And we have helped at the Free Speech Union, I think, in something like 40 cases involving NHS employees, many of whom, not all, but many of whom have been contacting us to say, look, there's this new policy at my workplace that I'm really concerned about. Often it will be a policy on transphobia and transitioning or something like that. And it will say that it is transphobic to say that you don't want to use the same facilities as somebody who is biologically of the opposite sex, that you must express support for trans colleagues, which of course can mean, you know, not discriminating against them. Okay, fair enough. Or it might mean that you have to go along with everything they say, and that there is no right to express concerns about things like toilets or changing rooms or this sort of stuff. And so that is the purpose of freedom of speech. In fact, it is to ensure that there are people who are able to say, hang on a minute, are we really sure that it's a good idea to medicalize a generation of children who are going to grow up basically to be gay or lesbian? And what's so frustrating, I think, I mean, is that I don't think there is anything that I've seen, at least in the reporting of this report, which would not have been the logical starting assumption 10 years ago in the medicine and the science of this. Now, the Free Speech Union, our remit does not include an interest in the issue itself. We're not here to campaign one way or the other on how the NHS interacts with children, teenagers who say they are trans. But we absolutely have a dog in the fight when it comes to the freedom of professionals and parents and others to say, I think this is completely insane. This is completely insane. And that silencing has now resulted in one of the worst, most egregious medical scandals in history, the fallout of which is going to go on and on and on and on, not least of which for the people who are the victims of it, who were never given the opposite point of view, were never given the arguments against this because doctors and parents and academics and teachers were muzzled.
Yeah.
So it's a complete disaster. It's obvious it was going to be a complete disaster. On this issue, as with so many others, we've had to move as a society at the rate of the slowest child in the class, I'm afraid, where it has taken a phenomenal amount of time to bludgeon people into accepting that experimenting on children is in fact a morally dubious, indeed morally bankrupt thing to do, that there is no scientific basis for it, and that silencing critics of any science is going to be something that in the long term is ruinous and counterproductive and harmful. So I obviously delighted that the report has come out and that it's addressed those freedom of speech points as well in the way that it has. And here we are. I mean, you know, it was all completely obvious 10 years ago. Longer.
It really was. And I think that point you make, we should underline twice, and actually we should put this into the chronicles of free speech in the United Kingdom. And in fact, we should put it into the chronicles of free speech across the world, that this is a textbook case where, in some sense, thinking that freedom of speech is dangerous, thinking that words are violence and are suppressing people's right to exist, which of course is total nonsense, that approach to the debate has led to real life harm and real world harm for a significant number of people, harm that we will be measuring for decades to come. And I think one of the things you've talked about a lot as well, Ben, of course, there's the type one error and there's the type two error. There's the harm that we see, there's the harm that is actually happens, and then there's the hidden harm by virtue of the things that people didn't do that they could have done, you know, in terms of taking a more constructive path by not joining this fight or by using their energies in another way. It's sort of like an opportunity cost for all the effort that's been expended in this. I mean, you know, going back to this free speech thing, you know, when was it? Liz Truss put a debate up in Parliament on extending the ban on puberty blockers to the private sector. I think it was something like that, just a few weeks ago. I mean, we are talking maybe 3 or 4 weeks before the CAS review was published, the final CAS review. There was an interim report 2 years ago, which addressed this issue of social transitioning not being a neutral act. But just 5 or 6 weeks ago, it was filibustered. And on both sides of the House, on all sides of the debate, we had members of Parliament standing up and talking about ferrets and their pets and naming all their pets, all the pets they'd had all their life. And these people, I saw it, they were smirking in the chamber around an issue that could have destroyed the lives and has destroyed the lives of some young people. And you're right, I have to be very careful here. We're not going to dive into the debate itself. I have strong views, you have strong views, but the idea of the debate that is clearly so important for our young people, a debate that is clearly so important for anyone in the country with gender dysmorphia, anyone in the country, for that to be filibustered shows exactly the point that Dr. Cass brings out in her foreword, that the debate has been toxified and that must stop. I mean, that I can see her finger wagging and there's that final sentence of the recommendation. This must stop. And she's right. She's right to be crystal clear on that.
of course, none of this, I fear, is going to restrain the sorts of people who embrace social manias of this type, as Lionel Shriver pointed out in a very good article for Unheard last week, I think it was, that there will be something else. And I fear that none of the people who have been those who have silenced and hounded opposition and forced this agenda through every part of public and private life, I don't think it's going to cause them any hesitation whatsoever when the next lunatic crusade arrives and they're happily joining up to it.
I think the huge thing that we forget, because our listeners, you, me, people at the Free Speech Union, our members, people that we help, are really up to speed with this debate. We've been following it over an extended period of time, and we know how it's gone over the last 4 years. There are a huge number of people who have just been truly ignorant, not through any fault of their own, but just because they're not in this space. They're not, that it hasn't been, as we said earlier, you know, the WPATH files were not reported at all on the BBC, on the mainstream media. So yeah. People haven't been equipped with the facts. People haven't. And this is the opportunity, I think, of Dr. Cass's report, is actually to engage with the majority of people who are sensible and who are simply not aware of the extremes of where this has got to. And when this report succeeds, and I think it will succeed in starting to reach more of those very reasonable people, then we can start to work around, at least on this issue, the ideologues. And we've had, or Dr. Cass has had to use the terminology of the radical activists and the vocabulary, because that was the only option. That was the only thing she could really do in writing this huge treatise, this huge report, a real quality piece of work. It's that first step of making people aware more broadly, working around the ideologues, and taking a real positive step. And it's gained traction, Ben, as you know. This report, this CAS report, has gained traction outside the UK already. It's being cited across other countries. I can't remember exactly what countries have already started to investigate.
It has been. And hopefully other countries will begin following Turf Island, as I think we're known as now.
We're known as Turf Island. I know. I think we're proudly Turf Island, aren't we? But I think this is... I totally agree with you. The ideologues are not going to recant. The religiously, the sort of the cultists who on either side of the debate can get quite absolutely religious about this, as we talk about every week. They're not going to suddenly turn around and say, "Oh, mea culpa, we were wrong." But it's reaching that majority so that they become irrelevant. Those very extreme activists simply become irrelevant, forgotten, and ultimately consigned to history. And of course, we're not saying in any of this, at any point are we saying that transgender people shouldn't be looked after. And in fact, Dr. Katz is very clear in her report that there are children with gender dysphoria, there are children who need real careful medical care, and there's a problem with waiting lists, and there needs to be a more holistic approach to them, but they need proper care and attention and concern, and the old first do no harm maxim needs to come back to the fore, and they need to be offered pathways, but not in the way that has happened over the last 10 years is also very, very clear from what she said. So yeah, it's a very emotive subject, but it's such an important report, I think, Ben, and I think it will be looked back on as such.
Yes, I agree. It's a landmark moment. We want to talk now about not a report, but a poll that was published by the Henry Jackson Society about a week ago, earlier in April. And this is a poll of British Muslims on all sorts of issues. The one issue or set of issues that we really want to focus on is the polling on, the finding, I should say, that 52% of British Muslims in this poll want to make it illegal to show a picture of the Prophet Muhammad. and this is a set of issues, actually personally, that has got me interested in free speech all the way back 10 or 15 years ago when I was sort of first thinking about
when you were young, Ben, not wanting to be ageist.
Yeah. Yeah. So this was what, you know, but really before the culture war reached these shores, this was the freedom of speech battle that I was interested in. It's the one that I remain most grievously concerned by. And this report also came just shortly before the publication later this week of Salman Rushdie's book, Knife, about the assassination attempt against him and the 15 stab wounds he sustained. So he's been all over the press in the Telegraph, interviewed today. We're speaking on Monday the 15th. And the point I wanted to make, Tom, first of all, and I'll hand over the baton in a moment, is that there was a similar poll that came out almost 10 years ago in 2015. And I was looking back this morning at a piece of writing I did at the time about that poll. And this was in the wake of the Charlie Hebdo attack. And it found that 10% of British Muslims aged 18 to 34 agreed with the statement that organizations which publish images of the Prophet Muhammad deserve to be attacked. 14% of over 45s agreed. And overall, 11% of British Muslims agreed with the statement. So 11% of British Muslims in all age categories, with 85% disapproving. So I think the point I draw from that is that if only 11% of British Muslims have some sympathy of some sort with terror attacks against people who publish cartoons of Muhammad, then it remains the case that we have a gigantic problem, even if it's only, in inverted commas, 11%. Now, this poll was 2015, almost a decade ago, and it is disheartening in the extreme to see that although this poll was not on that precise question, that there is such a large body of opinion within British Muslim communities which takes this view that any depiction of the Prophet Muhammad is completely forbidden, whether or not you're a practicing Muslim. And it seems to me completely clear that in the intervening 10 years, no progress has been made in changing minds or in attempting to change minds. And I don't know what the answer to this is, except for the rest of us to insist upon the right to say whatever we want at any time about the Prophet Muhammad or any other religious figure. And the consequences of that are made very clear in the pictures of Salman Rushdie in his blacked out glasses, having lost sight in one eye, and after a very, very long stay in hospital, recovering from the frenzied attack, which lasted just seconds, but was enough, of course, to change his life.
Yeah, you used a phrase last week, Ben, about howling in the wind, and it stuck with me because it's got in my head an image of a wolf or a dog, you know, howling up the wind or the moon or whatever it is. And that's, these polls come out and they are really important. You know, I'm very glad it has come out, but they do feel like howling in the wind. And I look at, as a kind of case study, I always go back to Charlie Hebdo and the various responses. You know, we could go back to Salman Rushdie and the 80s, but I go back to Charlie Hebdo and the responses of people after that. The mainstream media fell like dominoes when it came to the question of whether or not to republish the cartoons at that time, in the immediate aftermath of the horror of the editor and many other people in the newsroom of that magazine being knifed to death, essentially. And like dominoes, one by one, every single mainstream outlet said, we will not republish the cartoons, barring, of course, Charlie Hebdo itself, which did republish the cartoons. And I distinctly remember, and I think it might even have been Douglas Murray, saying, of course they did. They had no choice. You have to do that. When faced with that level of response to freedom of speech and expression, you have to push back hard. But of course, they stood up, they published them, and then they were standing alone. So the attempts that have been made are out there, and they're courageous, but thus far they've failed. They haven't had the traction that they ought to have had. And I guess we are reaping what we sow. You know, we did sow this problem back in the 80s when we didn't push back hard enough, perhaps, on the fatwa against Salman Rushdie and support him. Unyielding support. We didn't do that. So I feel like we're playing catch up. We're howling in the wind. You know, we're three squares behind on the snakes and ladders board of this issue. It is one of those issues. We talked about the CAS report. I've always said that we will solve the problem of biological reality being denied. I've always said, of course we will. There is absolutely no way that can't just be a sort of stupid moment in history where people said something that was biologically incorrect. But this, I don't know about this one, Ben. I don't know what the solution to this is.
What's most disturbing about the poll is when you look at the age breakdown, you can see on the question, for instance, of the desirability of having a Muslim political party, which one imagines would rapidly become, if not from the outset, be an Islamist political party. Actually, older Muslims are hostile to that. But the younger the cohort in this poll are, the more supportive of it they become. So 18 to 34 year olds are much more supportive of having a Muslim political party than the 50 to 64, but especially the over 65s. Then if you look at this question about making it illegal to show a picture of the Prophet Muhammad, the highest support for that comes from the 18 to 34 year olds. And one of the theories of the sociology of religion in the 19th and 20th century was this idea of secularization and the inevitability that religious faith would decline and that it would be replaced by the sort of rational utopia that new atheists predicted, but now which Richard Dawkins, among others, Ayaan Hirsi Ali, now of course a convert to Christianity, are admitting was not the result, and instead we have things like the CAS report required to sort out the mess in which we've got to in this post Christian age. And I just looking at those figures, and looking at reports like that by Dame Sarah Khan that came out a few weeks ago, or going again back a decade or so, when you look at the Casey Review on Social Cohesion, and you do have, I think, as we all know now, these insular, particular communities where, I mean, there was one striking finding from the Casey Review a decade ago that found that many Asian children, as it said, believed that the UK was, I think, 50% Asian or more, because that was the experience of the local area. And it seems quite clear that there has been no progress in bridging those divides. And from the tone and content of the review that came out more recently, it's clear that there has been no progress, in fact, at all. And so it seems to me that these views, which are so alien and hostile to freedom of speech, these views about depicting the Prophet Muhammad or criticizing or satirizing him, are only going to fester. And it takes a very courageous individual to speak out against it, particularly for a politician, somebody in public life. And I was quite pleased actually to see that Salman Rushdie really has held a grudge against people who didn't support him.
It is good to see people getting angry, isn't it? It feels like that's been one of the problems, is there hasn't been enough frustration and outrage. And we've mentioned this, the Royal Society of Literature, actually, didn't we? We mentioned that they were unwilling to make a very clear statement that said, you know, we stand by Salman Rushdie's right to say whatever he wants to say about whatever topic. And again, I feel I've talked about type one error and type two error. You know, we've got a problem of extremism here or extreme views within a particular community, a particular religion. But then the type two error is, okay, one of the ways to battle that is to have a really compelling alternative. What do we have? We have wet Christianity, woke Christianity, and we have woke ideology and youngsters running around trying to, with, you know, green hair and making it up as they go along and denying biological sex. You know, that is not attractive from people who are coming from a very clear, a very attractive clarity around what life is about. Why are we here? What's good? What's bad? What are my boundaries? And we need to offer an alternative. I think there's a huge opportunity here for muscular Christianity. Not the Christianity of the Church of England, but real muscular Christianity, which is rooted in strong doctrines and strong tradition and strong and faith, and provides community and provides all of those things that people are crying out for. People are crying out for community and for clarity and for structure. And, you know, if this rather extreme version of Islam is where they're finding it, that's where they're going to go. And so the report also says, the Henry Jackson report also says, we need to make sure we can help support and strengthen the voice of moderate Muslims. So those truths and that reality is then found in a moderate version of Islam. So, you know, but I do worry about that type two error. What else do we have to offer? What else are we offering youngsters other than empty vessels, in essence?
Yeah, and I think again, I mean, that youthful search for identity, for belonging, for a group to be part of, that of course is a huge part of the social contagion of the trans movement as well. You know, particularly I suppose during lockdown as well, and the social isolation of you know, being trapped in your bedroom, stuck online, many millions of teenagers were.
Which is really interesting, Ben, because we've come full circle. Because you mentioned a really important point, which I completely agree with. That's the, you know, young people searching for identity and struggling with it. Of course, if we went back to that advert I listened to over the weekend, we've been ageist throughout this. We've talked about different generations. We've talked about different grids that people look through at different stages of life. Not because we believe everyone's identikit. Not because we believe that, you know, everyone in Generation X is like that, everyone in Generation Z is like that, but because actually there are some themes, some important themes that help us with the debate. And this whole re-education is going to rip away not only this debate, but every debate. If we keep ripping away the framework by which we have these discussions and we make points like you've made, which is a very good point and a very valid point, we're going to rip it away. We're destroying it from every side. Goodness me, this is getting very dark and depressing at this stage, Ben.
Yes, but I would say that in response to that, and we're always very, we don't want to be doom and gloom and sort of pub bores saying the country's gone to the dogs. And I do think there are some really encouraging green shoots of recovery beneath the rubble. And I think you can point to examples, as we try to every week, Tom, of the ways in which common sense is beginning slowly to reassert itself. And it's quite clear that there is a demand for that reassertion. It's not the case, I think, that people are resigned to the mess we're in. Actually, I think people have a lot of fight left in us.
I think that's absolutely right. In fact, having the fight reinvigorates, doesn't it? It's like finding a purpose. It's sort of, it's no longer just the drudgery of doing a 9-to-5. I've got some meaning here. I can actually make a difference. I can start to turn the cultural tide. That sense of purpose is really, really helpful, I think. But it's an exciting time, Ben, as well, at the Free Speech Union, because I have cut the data from all of our casework for this quarter. So I've got it sitting on my desk right now, the next quarter's worth of data about the good work that you do, Ben, and your team does in supporting our members on their with their free speech problems. And every quarter we cut this data, we look at the number, our success rate, we look at the trends, you know, we'll have some early green shoot ideas about what's happened with the Hate Crime Act, where we're going with transgender ideology, and what's happened in the last 3 months or so. And certainly I can say with confidence, but I will have the number in front of me next week, we have seen an uptick, a definite uptick in the number of cases per quarter. Partly, obviously, I think because of membership going up, that's obviously correlated, but also because so many issues have hit our desk in the first quarter of 2024. We will report back more deeply next week on that.
Good. Well, I think that's us, isn't it, Tom?
I think that's us for the week. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Well, thanks for listening, everyone, and goodbye for now.
Goodbye for now.